Hey everybody, Jay here. Just want to let you know that what's going to follow is an interview with Jim Johnson, head dreamer of the Standish Group, and we're going to discuss the topic of decision latency theory. Oddly enough, when Jim and I recorded this episode was the same day that there was a massive Zoom outage, and it cut off the first 45 seconds of the recording. So I wanted to give you this bumper so the listener experience is not as jarring as it would be otherwise. Thanks again for all your support. Enjoy the episode.
And I like to call myself a dreamer because I like to dream about things getting better. I've been studying projects for about 25 years. I've studied transaction systems before that and did a lot of work with total cost of ownership. But I found the people process around making projects successful. But now I'm moving even more into the people process of trying to create what we call infinite flow. And improve, some people call it value stream, some people call it just flow, but it's basically getting groups of our teams and tribes to be able to work together effectively and be able to communicate. And the last 15 years, we've been studying about decision latency, and we found that it really impacts projects and will impact infinite flow and flow teams as well.
Perfect. So Jim, just to go into a little bit more detail, right? And the audio was a little bit dicey right when we started recording. So I'm hoping the recording got it. But I want to lead in with, you know, you're from the Standish Group. I guarantee you every practitioner who's listening right now has quoted the Chaos Report when it comes to transformations and the whole idea of, you know, in the old way, we used to spin up these giant projects and we would get as much budget as we could for as much scope as we could. And we would deliver as much as we could. And then we'd come to realize that nobody used any more than 20%.
Right. Yeah. That has been consistent for 25 years.
Which kind of makes you wonder. It kind of makes you wonder.
Right.
Definitely Einstein's definition of insanity. So, like Jim said in his intro, what we're going to talk about in this episode is we're going to start with decision latency theory, but then we're going to go into some of the other things that Jim and the Standish Group are working on. I came across this conceptually. I was reading Fabian Schwartz's great Your Scrum Playbook. It's poker, not chess. And in that book, he references decision latency theory. And I'd never heard of that before. So I was like, oh, okay, well, let me do some digging. You know, a couple of clicks in a Lulu order later, I have the book sitting in my lap. And there was some, and I think, Jim, based upon your, you know, long-running experience in the world of projects and programs and IT delivery, right? Not even just IT delivery, just delivery overall. You sit in a unique spot where you can do trend analysis going back, you know, for quite a long time. And there was some anecdotes in here that I pulled out that I thought were really kind of impressive. The first one that jumped out at me is a project will create one decision for every $1,000 in labor cost. Can we talk about that? Because that is like mind-blowing to just sit back and think about some of the big ticket budget things that I myself have worked on. That's a lot of decisions.
Yes, it is. And we had done a lot of research into this to come up with that number. Now it's a sort of a guideline, but we find that overall, looking at all kinds of projects and teams and there are different types of decisions. There's a lot of critical decisions, but there's also thousands of other decisions where a team has to make a decision. And if it has to go up, say, two or three ladders, it creates a lot of decision latency.
And, you know, speaking of decision latency, one of the other data points you had in the book that I started to dig into, I really started to get my head was kind of sort of blown, was the actual raw numbers where statistically, teams that make decisions in under an hour have a 58% success rate, whereas teams that take 5+ hours have an 18% success rate, which is a delta of, I think it's like 300%, right? Mm-hmm. That's crazy. That's crazy to think about.
Yeah, but you think about this. I think about time. You know, economists always talk about time and time for money. If you're doing nothing for an hour, or thinking about decisions for 5 hours, you're not productive. So it causes great pain. You know, we look at projects and we say, you know, this project should have taken a year. and yet it takes 3 or 4 years. What were they doing? What were they doing in that time? and you say, okay, well, you know, and you look at meetings, right? You say, okay, well, I had a lot of meetings, you know, they had a steering committee meetings and project review meetings and all these, and you find it meetings sometimes would go in for a couple of hours with 20 people, you know, talking about things and making decisions. And then next week they reverse those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two big time sinks that I saw. One was meetings and the other was change management. And to make a change in a project can cost more, making the decision about a change in a project can cost more than actually making the change, which I thought was astounding, but I went over the numbers several different ways, and it can cost 10 times as much to make a decision about a change than it does to make the change itself.
And that's from the practitioner, right? From those of us that are in the trenches, that makes total sense, because if all it takes is one sponsor to say, hey, maybe we go with vanilla ice cream instead of chocolate for the post success happy hour, that literally can spiral into, like you said, a 20 person steering committee, and meetings have the law of diminishing returns, or once you get over three people, it starts to be less and less productive. Mm-hmm. And you can extrapolate that to the number of decisions, even using the rubric you suggested. That is where, like you said, unproductive time and then just a time sink. You're waiting, you hurry up to wait, basically.
Yeah. And so when we kind of looked at it and was measuring, we said, okay, the actual time, the interval, what we call the interval, you know, the time between when a issue comes about and when you actually make the decision is more costly than making a bad decision. Because you can always reverse, or should be able to reverse without too much trouble in software. Now, if you're building a bridge, that might be different.
Right.
But in software, you can, you know, you can have some interesting recoveries.
And that ties to the other quote I pulled out from early on in the book, where it says the value of the interval is greater than the quality of the decision. So it's not only the ability to make decisions, but you also want to build in the speed by which to change your decision based upon new learnings.
Right. Or make, you know, you go down this road and you find it's a dead end. You say, okay, let's back up and, you know, and that time is less than time that you would spend in a 20 people meeting trying to make a firm decision.
Right. And then and applying this to, you know, what we do in the Agile space, 2 weeks of a wasted sprint is a lot better than 20 weeks of a wasted program that was set to go 84 months or 20 months even that you realize, well, the market has changed and we've, you know, the sunk cost fallacy then kicks in. Well, we've already spent this money. Let's just keep going. And you're driving the plane right into the mountain, right? It's terrible.
Yeah. And it's so much better. I mean, what we need to increase flow and we're trying, and that's, and decision flow is really a big part of that. So we want to get fast feedback. I mean, it's really important. First of all, users don't like change. Let's face it. Yet Amazon and Google make changes all the time, but we don't really see them because they just become natural.
Right.
So if we can have fast feedback and, you know, certainly getting something done in a day is preferable than getting something done in 6 weeks or 2 week sprint even, but getting it done at the end of a year is crazy. You know, these projects, they go on for a year and then you find out you give it to the user and they throw up on it. They can't.
Right, right. The best example to that, Jim, is look at the past year with COVID, right? Every single company had a plan about what they were going to do in 2020. And then by March, the entire world shifted out from under them. So if you were married, to your point, if you were married to an 18-month initiative and it was going to start in January of 2020, well, what did that look like in April 1st?
Right. And people were scrambling. There's some great examples of companies that couldn't to send their people home, and took a long time to get up to speed on that. And there's one example of a company that was had already prepared for that, and not knowing that they were going to be prepared, they just happened to be prepared looking at remote workers. And years and years ago, HP decided that they were going to send a lot of people back home and work from home, and deleted a lot of offices. So they were kind of prepared as well, and those kind of companies. So if you were prepared, you were in good shape.
Right, and not only were the companies that were prepared, they were ready. The companies that are, like, to back to your initial point, that are comfortable with that constant change, that had built in the, you know, build plan, what's the Jardine of London quote, design for redesign, right? So if the companies that were ready to just accept it and go with it were the ones that survived.
Right, yeah.
So I want to talk about, Jim, how do teams, so we're talking about decision latency, and we can universally agree that teams that make decisions quicker are more successful, extrapolate that upwards. Organizations that make better decisions quicker can be more successful. How do we make teams, enable them to make more better decisions faster, right? What are the ways that we can start thinking to get these teams, you know, I hate to use the empowered word because it's beaten to death in the agile space, but how do we get them going down that path?
Okay, so, you know, we've been looking at this for a long time. We feel that if you have a competent sponsor, now we're kind of talking about sponsor of a team, and you have that team built around, you know, the stuff they know how to do, you know, so they have the skills. And if you can have a sponsor that empowers the team with the decisions, or basically keeps them out of their way and gives them a basic vision, and they work on the vision of that sponsor, then they're much more productive because they sort of know what to do. But they also, if they get fast feedback, they say, okay, well, here's what we did. What do you think? Oh, that sucks. Okay, well, let's try this, you know?
Right.
And if you look from an organization point of view, and that's one of the things, the dynamics of the organization, if you have lots of sponsors and smaller teams, then you can take the vision from the organization, and the sponsor can take that vision and apply it to their own area of responsibility.
And that ties to another, you know, you have a conceptually in the reading, you have this thing you call the winning hand, right? Which is the five things that contribute to greatly successful teams being able to make decisions quicker. You talked about a skilled sponsor owner, but one, now you're going into small teams work best.
It's because small teams can make quick decisions, number one, because they even make decisions without even talking, right? Because the longer a team is together, the more comfortable they are. If you have a sponsor that can sort of say, well, I would have made this decision or I would have made that decision, but, you know, since you made it, let's go with it and let's do this. Then you have some feedback from that as well. And you have it close to the team. So being close to the team, whether it's remote or, you know, together, doesn't really matter. But you want to have that fast feedback. And if you have feedback from the users who are actually going to use the product, then that gives you that feedback as well. So we say there's actually four levels of feedback that we're interested in. And it's all about value and customer satisfaction. We don't, you know, the whole artificial on time, on budget, on target should be thrown out the window. It's artificial, it's useless, it doesn't mean anything. In fact, we shouldn't even have project budgets. Maybe a project budget for an MVP, but after that, it should be just team.
Mm-hmm.
You fund the team, you don't have to worry about budget, you don't have to worry about anything. All you have to do is worry about, yeah, are the customers happy? You know, yeah, they get this, they like that. Oh, they're not happy. Well, what do they want? Well, they want this or that, you know, so let's change it. And if you get that fast feedback, that decision helps you, you know, so the getting the feedback from the users is actually really a powerful decision. So you have what we call the producers or the product owners that work with the sponsor and get the vision and then interpret that into things the team can work on. And then they put it in, you know, an area that they can then optimize on the most important things. So they optimize it, the team does the work, they see it's working, show it to the sponsor says yes or no, or doesn't like it, or does like it, they get some more feedback. It goes to the users, get their feedback. And then, you know, later on, you can do a retrospective and your team gets better and better. It's really a continuous improvement process when you think about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that ties to, you know, Peter Merrill has a lot of stuff around, you know, lowering the decision-making floor. It's a Dan Mezick thing, but Peter Merrill talks about, you know, create those feedback loops to be long-lived and quick response and make everybody talk to one another. And when you talk about continuous improvement, that's one of those things where, you know, organizations need to consistently put that effort into it. To quote Mike Burrows, PDCA is not a perpetual motion machine, right? You need to consistently make the emphasis of, we want to lower that decision-making floor. You know, we want to make sure these feedback loops exist, they're maintained, they're cultivated, and they're consistently feeding each other. One of the things you talked about, I wonder if you could explain. So when you talk about teams making decisions, you know, there's obviously the whole, you know, distribute based upon roles, responsibilities. This ties to skin in the game. This ties to, you know, lowering the decision-making floor. Peter Merrill, Jürgen Appelo, everybody's written on this stuff. You also talk about a decision pipeline. Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah, this was a concept we felt that, especially in a larger type project, that you'd create a pipeline. We saw this in a couple of companies in Europe where they had decisions at the higher level and all going all the way down to the lower level. But the pipeline would be what the sort of wherever you want it, however you want to create the thing. But say the pipeline might be at the CEO level of the vision, and then going down to the groups and then into the teams or into the tribes. And so they would have a division of responsibility or decision of what type of decisions in the pipeline they would make. So at the lower level, the people would make all the decisions on you know, execution, where in the above things would be about more about the vision and the ideas and the concepts and, you know, that kind of stuff.
And that is the upper level stuff is more the strategic stuff, if I'm following you correctly. It's the portfolio type. This is the direction in roughly in which we want the boat to go.
Right. Right. So, you know, so the captain would tell you that we want to go to Brazil and the engineer would steer it that way, you know.
Right, right. Which is, it's interesting that, you know, when you speak of the greater, you know, capital A agile world at large, there's always this push to, you know, truly make these egalitarian systems and do away with leadership and all that. And I just think that, I think that's a little bit short-sighted to make those kind of statements. The most informed thing I've read in that regard, Dave Snowden put out a blog post the other day where he said, you want to decentralize decision-making, but centralize coordination. And I thought that was that second part for him is the missing link, right? You need some semblance of, you know, I hate to say the managerial class, but some semblance of leadership to help coordinate all these disparate decisions going on in real time.
Yeah, I think I like to think about it more like vision. You know, this is the vision, and, you know, you keep hammering on the vision of what the organization will do, and not so much the tactical aspects until you get down to the tribe or team.
And do you see, Jim, that's, you know, when I was a project manager, I'm a reform project manager. I don't make any bones about it. When I was a project manager, one of the biggest pain points from that role is when you have people who should be worrying about the strategic aspect coming down and worrying about the tactical and getting too close to the nuts and bolts. They should be steering. You should be above deck, guiding the ship, not down below telling me how to row. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we had the scale on our sponsors. We call it the deadbeat dad in the mother hen. and then you fall into the perfect sponsor in the middle. But you can get, you know, people that just don't give you anything, and then you have the mother hen that wants to tell you what socks to wear that day.
Right, right. It is for those leaders listening, it is a delicate balancing act, right? And I dare say, Jim, that probably comes away from trust, right? If there's a healthy level of trust between the doers and the deciders, right? I think that there's a comfortability that you don't have to mother hen so much because you trust your people to do the right thing.
Right. And that's really, the team has to make promises and they have to follow through with their promises because that's how they gain trust.
Right.
And then they test each other, you know, and, you know, you'll have some toxic people that can ruin the team and you have to do something about that. But, you know, if the team trusts each other and you don't get these egomaniacs that think they know everything, you know, they work together as a team versus, you know, individuals, I think you're much better off.
And speaking of that with trust and teams, I want to go back to the winning hand, right? We talked about the winning hand. We kind of touched on it, but we didn't go into detail for the listeners. So we kind of, if we lost you listeners, I'm sorry. So the winning hand, we talked about how small teams are best. We talked about how you want a highly skilled sponsor or a product owner. Now we're starting to talk about trust, which ties into the one of the other cards in the winning hand is the organization, right? An organization should be highly skilled. I believe you also talk about emotional agility.
Yeah, you know, you really, and this gets back to a lot of team dynamics, but, and we actually did some work with marriage counselors on trying to figure out what makes a good marriage and what, you know, and apply that to teams. So, and trust was always a big thing and, you know, and solving issues. There were two types of problems, one that are solvable and one that are not. So how do you deal with problems you can solve and you work through that, but then you have these issues around things that you can't solve. And this really, and you know, how do you work with that? Because this could cause the marriage to fail. There's a guy in Seattle, Gottman, who says he can tell a marriage is going to fail within 17 seconds.
I think I remember reading that article somewhere. It's pretty exciting. I'd love to have him talk to me and my wife, but then I don't think I really want to know the answer.
But if you look at the emotional maturity of a team, and we have the book called The Good Mate, how you work with people, I think it's really important. And a team is like a marriage, especially if it's a smaller team of six people or less. You know, they really have to get to work with each other and know each other.
Well said, well said. And finishing out the winning hand, so we talked about small teams, we talked about a highly skilled organization, we talked about Agile and Scrum, we've talked about Agile and Ready, how those small chunks of work, tighter time boxes help. And you also talk about team skills, right? So being well-versed in process, like agile process as it was designed, technologically mature. I would like to think that that's probably one of the bigger cards in the hand that's kind of tough to get your head around.
Right. I think this is really important to take an inventory of the work you're going to do and the people that are going to do it. And if you have people on the team that have certain skills that can do the work, then that's really important. But if you don't, you know, they just don't have the cognitive ability, then you have to figure out how to augment that. Either, you know, bring in somebody that will educate them on that area, work with them a little bit. You want to the other thing is, you know, you want to have a pretty diverse team if you're talking about value flow. You don't want to have everybody being a database person, you know, and especially if you're going to the customer, you want to have some really good skills about talking to the customer and being able to do multiple things and then being able to implement it quickly. because nothing, you know, if you create this thing and then you take 6 months to create it, then all you have is one data point, right?
Right.
But if you create it and then you implement it and you give it to the customer, then you have, you know, one data point, but it's a quicker data point. Then if you do, say, 2 week sprints, then you'll have multiple data points over 6 months. You'll have 12 data points. And data feedback, data points is really, really important. And that's why we talk about optimizing. We talk about actually, a lot of organizations will, they buy these requirements tools and they go out and talk to the customer and they write them all down and they do all this stuff and they spend, 2 years doing it. And then they build the product, maybe a year or two. And then, so they don't know if the requirements are any good until the thing's done. And they go after minor details. I like to say the team should search for the obvious.
Right, right. Get the, I mean, to use the tried and true statement of low-hanging fruit, right? It should be right in front of your face, right? If you're digging that far, you're tunneling way deeper than you have to.
Right.
I mean, speaking of requirements, if I never see IBM rational doors again, I will live a long and successful life. That was quite painful.
Yeah.
Quite painful in the old days. So building off the winning hand, Jim, you talk about the concept of pure success, right? And pure success is a project, a program, an initiative that has not only a high customer satisfaction, but a high return on value. Basically, you get way more out of the money you spent than you planned for. And your data points show that when teams use this concept of the winning hand, they have a 70% chance of actually attaining this pure success. High customers highly satisfied with the investment that was made coming out the gate, which I think is, that's kind of like a cheat sheet, right?
Yeah, I mean, why are you building? You have to say, why am I doing this? Why am I doing it? I'm not doing it to be on time, on budget, on target. I'm doing it to satisfy a customer need. I should have that, I should know that customer need, and I should be able to deliver quickly and get that feedback from the customers. This is what you want, And that's the nice thing about an agile team. They can deliver quickly and they can put it in place and customers can say, no, I like that. I don't like that. Google and Amazon is famous for doing this stuff.
Perfect. Perfect. So, Jim, you talked about it early on. I know it's a little bit off topic with decision latency theory, but I want to go into a little bit about the work you're starting to expand on under the concept of flow, right? Most agilists, anybody who's taken a Kanban course, I'm sure everyone listening has probably read Reinertsen. If you haven't, shame on you, you probably should. But all the concepts around flow are really starting to become apparent in especially our agile world, right? We have stuff like, you have stuff like the flow system, which just came out, Nigel Thurlow, and I think it's John Houston. You have, moving from project to product from Mick Kirsten. You have Steve Tendon's theory of constraints-based tame flow, right? Getting value flow through the system. So it seems to me like a lot of people are starting to wake up to this idea that it's not so much about the agile process or the agile tools or, what framework you're using. It's really around getting value of flow out the door. And I know you're starting to poke into that. So can we talk a little bit more about what you and your team are doing regarding that concept?
Yeah. So we came up with the concept. Well, years ago, we talked about funnels and we call them micro projects. Now they're called microservices. I'm going to say about 1998, we started looking at this and we started talking about it in terms of the agile process. The agile process was coming on. We didn't know really what it was at that time. We knew it was the iterative process. So we started to think about how we could speed things up. And certainly going back to 1994, we said you can't have these big projects, but people took it and created this monster called the Project Management Industrial Complex, building big tools like Clarity and Microsoft servers and stuff like that, and really started to get on the thing of building this whole industry around projects, especially software projects. And we saw that flow. First of all, it was a catharsis. I came up with this thing reading about a book called Infinity, and I said, wait a minute, software is not a project. Software goes on forever. There are applications out there that are 40 years old. Right? And people are saying, okay, I'm going to replace it with a project. Well, wait a minute. You know, these things have a life of their own. Companies are using this. Why aren't we taking care of it? Then we talk about, you know, Manny Lehman and, you know, his theories. And so we said, wait a minute, let's stop talking about projects. Let's be the anti-project. And let's talk about, you know, infinite flow. These systems are going to go on forever. Let's make them so they go on forever.
Right.
And when you do that, then you say, okay, you have this guy that's been writing COBOL for 20 years, 25 years. He knows the system, but he's going to retire pretty soon. How do you keep that, you know, institutional knowledge? And, you know, some of these systems are going to fall apart pretty soon. And some of them are pretty critical. We need to have a concept that says, okay, we're going to invest in improving these systems and constantly improving them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we came up with Infinite Flow.
Awesome. That's fan. I love it. And I look forward to hearing more about it as time goes on. I do think that's the key to the success, right? It's like you said, these things, they will outlive you. They do take on a life of their own. And it's not so simple as, oh, we're just going to rebuild it in some, you know, HTML5 web-based, you know, MVC, whatever term you want to use. It's not that simple. It's never that simple. And again, these things have, there's also the institutional knowledge that gets built into these applications inadvertently, that how do you replace that? You know,
right. People don't know what's in the code because John Jones left, died, you know, whatever, he's gone. You know, what does this thing actually do? I don't know. Okay, let's build around it. But you don't actually know what's in there.
Right. I am, Jim, I am 43, and I am not embarrassed to say that I have come across applications that are older than me that are still being used in multiple large enterprises where you're kind of like, wow, I guess they built it to be resilient at last. And then you're like, well, what happens if they turn that off? What goes on? It just goes totally insane.
About 10 years ago, I was looking at some demand deposit accounting software, and I found out it was written in 1968 in 1401 autocoder.
Jeez.
And that was for a very large bank.
Punch cards and stuff sitting in a filing cabinet somewhere, man.
Yeah, I mean, if you're buying a plane ticket on any major airline, it's probably being executed in what we call the airline control program, which was renamed TPF. That's, you know, no one knows how to operate that.
It's like when you go to your dealer to have your car serviced and they pull up an old green screen application. It's like, I know what that thing's running on. That's an AS/400 somewhere. That's not going to be fun to update, man. We could really go down the technology rabbit hole. So Jim, I know we're quickly approaching time. I don't want to keep you that long. Where can our listeners, if they want to find you, if they have more questions, they want to get more information, not only just about the Standish Group, but decision latency theory, all the other projects, the massive amounts of data you've compiled, where do they find you?
Well, standishgroup.com, and you can register for free.
Perfect. Perfect. Again, I want to thank Jim for coming on. Never in a million years did I think I'd be talking to the guy who runs the Standish Group. So this is kind of like a interesting Mount Everest moment for me. So I want to thank Jim for taking time to come on today. I want to thank all of you on behalf of Jim myself. I want to thank all of you listeners for tuning in and listening again. If you enjoyed the episode, give us a review, a rating, iTunes, Stitcher, your podcast platform of choice. If you want to learn more and get in on the conversation, we have a very vibrant Discord server. We'll throw that in the show notes. And once again, we are totally committed to being free 5 years in a row. But if you do like what you've heard, we do have a Patreon. Chip in if you want to chip in. We always appreciate it. It helps offset hosting costs. And you'll probably get a surprise in the mail from me. So once again, I want to thank Jim Johnson from the Standish Group for joining us today. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast signing out.